I would like to call to order the second working group meeting of our joint charter school working group. And Representative Slocum and I, Kathy Saltzman, are chairing this group. And today, our testimony will focus on the report on charter schools that came from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We'll also be hearing from the Department of Education, and then we'll be having some public testimony. And I do want to thank all of our members from both the House and Senate who are serving on this working group. I think we had a wonderful first meeting and looking at some of the background of charter schools and the leadership that we've had in this state on that issue. And I hope that we continue to lead on this issue. And but we do have some topics that I think it's important for us to discuss in a very responsible and balanced way. So this working group really provides an opportunity for us outside of the session to have those discussions, to hear conversations, and ask questions. And I know that there will be follow-up in Senator Wieger's committee and Representative Mariani's committee as well. So please keep us posted. And I think all of us would like to hear from you. I know that we're also going to be offering all of our members an opportunity to sign up to do some charter school visits. I know a number of us have done those already. But if you have not had the opportunity, we'll be passing that around so you can sign up for a specific time. We're also developing a list of questions that hopefully will be helpful for you as you visit charter schools. But we do have some very controversial issues to discuss, and I really hope that you will see that we are doing that in a very balanced and also responsible way. So with that, Representative Slocum, would you like to add anything today?
Just that I'm excited about the visits that legislators will make to the charters. I think that you learn a lot by going and seeing what's actually going on. You can read umpteen reports, but until you've actually been in the situation and been in the environment, it's hard to make some decisions, and there are going to need to be some decisions made. So I look forward to those visits. I think it's going to be very interesting.
Very good. You know, a number of people have also, you know, have come to visit me and have asked what's the intent of this working group. And I think that our focus is on oversight and accountability issues. Along the way, we'll be hearing about some other, things that have been brought up and that they may be dealt with in other committees, particularly our finance committees, if there are some oversight issues there. So, again, this is a starting point for that discussion. So at this time, I'd like to invite Judy Randall, who is the project manager on the Legislative Auditor's Report on Charter Schools, to the table. And welcome, Ms. Randall. Thank you so much for being here with us today and for your work on this report.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Judy Randall, and as you said, I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'm pleased to be here today to talk with you all about our evaluation of charter schools. Before I get started, I'd like to thank my colleague, Sarah Roberts, seated here in the audience, who helped me with the evaluation. Evaluation was released to the Legislative Audit Commission, as you know, in June of this year. I'm going to get started by just doing a little brief overview of charter schools. I know that a couple weeks ago you all had a hearing where the history was covered, and some of this was covered too, but I'm just going to do it real quick to give a little bit of context to what I'm going to be talking about. As you know, Minnesota was the first state to authorize charter schools, and it did so in 1991. And the idea behind charter schools, again, as you know, was to increase educational choice for students and their families. Charter schools operate outside of the traditional school district structure, so parents, teachers, community members get together and they form a public school that operates separately from the traditional, again, school district structure. Charter schools are exempt from some education laws. Now, I should note that charter schools actually have to comply with most of the laws that apply to traditional school districts, but they are exempt from some of them. And in exchange for that flexibility, charter schools are subject to an additional layer of oversight, which is provided by sponsors. And we'll be talking a lot about sponsors through this presentation. Sponsors are organizations that authorize charter schools and then are responsible for monitoring the fiscal and academic performance of charter schools. Sometimes people think the name sponsor is weird because it almost implies that they financially support a charter school, and that's not the case. I just want to emphasize that. Other states often refer to sponsors as authorizers, so if that helps clarify kind of their role. Briefly talking about charter schools and the students who attend them, some of these numbers are a little old. This is from the 06-07 school year. There are about 24,000 charter school students. This represented about 3% of the K-12 student population. Last year, I believe there were about 28,000 charter school students, so the number of students has grown. Last year, there were 143 charter schools in operation. I think that has also grown, so the number is a little over 150 charter schools now in operation. And charter schools are located across the state, and this map here shows where they're located. Most charter schools are located in the 7-county Twin Cities metropolitan area, and a majority of those are located in Minneapolis or St. Paul. But you can see they're spread out, you know, really across the state in all four corners. Well, three corners and close to the fourth. Here are some demographics of the charter school students. The red bars are charter school students. The yellow bars are district school students. So you can see this is for 2007. In charter schools, over half of the students were eligible for free or reduced price lunch, as compared with 30% of district school students. Similarly, over half of charter school students are minority students, compared with 22% of district school students. 21% of charter school students are classified as limited English proficiency, as compared with 7% of district school students. And then special education, you can see those numbers are closer, and in fact, district schools have a slightly larger percentage of special education students, 14% as compared with 12%. So I kind of flew through that. It's just a high-level overview of students in charter schools and the basic premise. Most of the recommendations of our evaluation focus on oversight, accountability, and the structure of charter schools in the state. But we did do a little bit on student performance, so I'm going to touch on that briefly, and then I'll move on to the parts about oversight and accountability, which it seems are the focus of this working group. When we looked at charter school performance, we used 2007 MCA2 data, so the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessment Series 2 data. And there were some limitations to the data, and we kind of want to get those right up front. First of all, we just looked at 1 year of data, just from 2007. And secondly, the MCA2 data itself just provides a snapshot of performance. It shows how students were performing against the state standard. It doesn't show a measure of growth that the student may have achieved over the course of a year. So we think that's important to note, but despite these limitations, we still think there's some useful insights that can be gathered from looking at this snapshot of data. Our kind of the quick cut of the data says that statewide charter schools did not perform as well as district schools. One example of this is looking at the rate at which schools made adequate yearly progress, or AYP. And as you know, AYP is a measure of a school's compliance with the federal No Child Left Behind requirements. In 2007, 50% of charter schools made AYP, as compared with 68% of district schools. So using this AYP measure, charter schools did not perform as well. But we wanted to dig a little deeper into the data, especially in light of those student demographics that I showed you on the previous slide. So what we did is we tried to match up charter schools with similar district schools. We call these the comparable schools or the comparable group of district schools. So we did this on a couple of different dimensions. First, what we did is we divided the state into four regions: Minneapolis, St. Paul, Twin Cities metro area, excluding the inner cities, and then outstate Minnesota. And then within each of those regions, we matched charter schools up with district schools that had similar percentages of minority students and similar percentages of students that were eligible for free and reduced price lunch. And then we looked at the way the charter school students performed. And when we compared the charter school students' test scores on the MCA2 to these comparable district schools, to the students in these comparable schools, we found, again, still that charter schools did not perform as well. Now, there was some variation. Oh, first, let me give some examples, I guess. On the MCA2 math test, for example, 15% of the charter schools performed better than their comparable group of district schools, but 51% of charter schools performed worse on their comparable group of district schools. So kind of as a whole, charter schools still didn't perform as well when compared with this comparable group of district schools. But there was variation, and of course, some charter schools did perform better than their comparable district schools. And in fact, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, charter schools in Minneapolis and St. Paul were more likely to outperform their district schools than were charter schools in other regions of the state. We also looked at a couple of other factors that the national research shows is related to student performance. Particularly, we looked at special education enrollment, rates of limited English proficiency, and then also mobility rate. And as you probably know, mobility is a measure of the student turnover in a school during the school year. And we found that mobility seemed to be pretty highly related to the student achievement and academic performance of a school. And we found that when we accounted for mobility, in addition to region, minority rates, and free and reduced price lunch, the differences in performance between charter schools and their comparable district schools became quite narrow. Now, on the whole, charter schools still didn't perform as well, even accounting for all those factors, but the differences were much smaller. So I know I've just thrown kind of a lot of detailed information about you at you about performance, and we can come back to that more if you'd like. But for now, I'd like to move on and talk about the oversight and the accountability and the focus of our recommendations. But let me, I guess, just sum up the performance findings in maybe two or three quick sentences. One, in general, charter schools weren't performing as well, but there's variation, and when you account for several different factors, the differences in performance got really small. That's kind of the big takeaway.
Chair?
Excuse me, Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, is it all right if we ask a couple questions sure. with regard to performance now?
Yes, that would be fine. So, Senator Bonoff, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do, Ms. Randall. And I think this is difficult because what we don't know is how these students performed in their own public schools prior to coming to these charter schools. And when you think about the type of student that might find themselves in a charter school, you could have a hypothesis that perhaps they weren't doing well in their public school. So then they get, you know, the parent makes a choice, makes a change. So it's difficult without looking at the trajectory that they were on in a public school versus the trajectory they're on in the charter school. And so I don't know how one would separate that.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I absolutely agree. I think there's a lot of limitations to looking at test score data and evaluating charter school performance based on that. I think, you know, you don't have the growth or the, you don't have the student progress mark. And so you don't, you know, you can't do, there's a lot of issues. First of all, you can't do the fall to spring, how much did they grow in this school year, you know, in this school. Secondly, as you point out, you don't know how they would have done somewhere else. Yeah, and you'll never know that. And, of course, that's always a complication with research and education. I mean, you can't really do a perfectly controlled experiment because you're not going to withhold options from people. Thirdly, you know, it's a choice option, and clearly people are making the choice to attend the school, so they must be finding something of value to them, and it might not necessarily be test scores. I mean, we spoke with teachers. We spoke with families. We spoke with lots of different people, and you know, not everybody is necessarily choosing a school only based on the academic performance of that school. So, I mean, there's a lot of factors that go into this, and I agree. I think you need to look at this type of data carefully, but I also think it's still useful. And I guess this is why I think it's still useful, because the state has standards for all students. You know, they expect all students to meet, you know, the state standards and perform proficiently on the MCA 2 or whatever assessment we're using to measure those standards. And so there's kind of two different types of measuring performance. One is the growth and how would they have done anyways, and the MCA 2 won't get that. So a kid could be coming to a charter school three grade levels behind, take the test and only be one grade level behind, but they're still not meeting that standard, but that student has made remarkable progress. So that's one measure, is that growth factor. The other measure is we're expecting all kids to meet this standard, period. And it doesn't matter how much they've grown. And that's what this measures. And that's what this stuff
Follow-on
is.
Follow-on question, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Ms. Reynolds, I would assume these students have Mars numbers. So it seems to me that we could actually do some historical look back and see where they were performing relative to the standards in a prior school, and that also underscores the importance of electronic record sharing so that that kind of analysis and data could be done just in a snap.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, I think ideally, yes. I think that's the goal to strive for. There's a lot of complications, of course. You know, the devil's in the details. The test instrument change, so the MCA versus the MCA 2. So those are different tests, and they're not easily crosswalkable, not a word, but you know what I mean. And so there's complications there. And then, yeah, they all have Mars numbers, but there's a lot of I think I would let the department speak to this a little bit more than I, but I think going forward, those MARS numbers will likely be more reliable and more reliable. I think going back, I'm not sure how reliable they are.
Thank you. It just does point to there's more questions than answers, yes. But I do appreciate the report. Thank you.
Are there other questions? Would you like to proceed with the accountability part of the report? Thank you.
Certainly. Okay, so when we looked at the oversight and accountability piece of it, probably not surprisingly, we found that charter school oversight is unclear and really quite complicated. As you probably know, each charter school must have a sponsor that I talked about who authorizes the charter school and then monitors the school's academic and financial performance. The Department of Education also has oversight responsibility of each charter school. So we put together this simple diagram, but it kind of shows some of the complications that arise. You got the Minnesota Department of Education at top. It has direct responsibility and oversight over the charter school board. Similar to school districts, charter schools have charter school boards. The boards are elected by the teachers in the school and the parents of the students who attend the school. So the Department of Education has direct oversight over the board, which has direct oversight over the charter school. And then you can see the Department of Education has this kind of dashed or broken line over sponsors. And then sponsors also have a direct responsibility oversight over the charter school board. So, you know, there's a lot of kind of overlapping responsibility lines and unclear lines. And we're going to talk a lot about this broken line between the Department of Education and sponsors, but we'll address some other stuff with the charter school board as well. So let's first talk about sponsors. last year, there were 53 sponsors in the state. This year, I believe there's about 50. By law, certain organizations can be charter school sponsors. Higher education institutions, so for example, Hamline University is a charter school sponsor. Independent school districts can be sponsors, so the St. Paul Public School District is a sponsor. LeSueur Henderson School District is a sponsor. Intermediate school districts can be sponsors. Nonprofit organizations that meet certain asset requirements can be sponsors. So Volunteers of America is a sponsor. Pillsbury United Communities is a sponsor. Audubon is a sponsor. Education districts, which are also collaboratives of school districts, can be sponsors, but none are. And then the Department of Education currently sponsors some charter schools through a grandfather clause, but they're not allowed to sponsor new charter schools on a new basis. Let's see. And as we've talked about, sponsors approve charter schools, and then this is the language in law. Sponsors monitor and evaluate the fiscal and student performance of the charter schools they sponsor. Now, as part of our evaluation, we visited 10 sponsors, so about 20% of the sponsors. We visited 14 charter schools, so 10% of the charter schools, and then we sent a questionnaire to all of them, all of the sponsors and all of the charter schools. And we found that the amount of oversight provided by sponsors really varies quite a bit. Some sponsors are very involved and engaged in their oversight responsibility. They require monthly financial reports. They require monthly school board minutes. They require regular updates on academic performance. They attend charter school board meetings. They visit the school. They're really engaged in this oversight role. Some sponsors have more of a hands-off approach. Some of them only meet once a year with their charter school. One sponsor we visited meets once a year with its charter school to receive a report that the charter school prepared. So there's really a lot of difference in terms of the amount of oversight these sponsors are providing. And we also found that some sponsors actually don't feel equipped to perform all of their sponsor duties. We heard from many sponsors that they didn't feel that they had the financial expertise to oversee a charter school's financial health or financial records. One sponsor we met with didn't know that her charter school hadn't made adequate yearly progress in the year before. She hadn't necessarily been tracking the academic performance of the school. One sponsor said he wasn't really sure what the sponsor's role is. So there's a lot of variation in terms of the interest and the ability and the amount of how engaged they are and their expertise in terms of taking on that sponsor role. And we think that some of the sponsors are not necessarily fulfilling the requirements that are expected as laid out in law. We think some of this variation in oversight by the sponsors is due in part to the lax oversight over sponsors by the Department of Education and some unclear authority that the department has over sponsors. And we found really that there's gaps with respect to charter school oversight, and then there's also some duplication. Let's talk first about the gaps. The Department of Education does not approve a sponsor's overall ability to sponsor a charter school. So a sponsor doesn't go through its own independent application process to be a sponsor. Similarly, the department doesn't hold sponsors accountable to standards. There's no, again, ongoing review to make sure a sponsor has the expertise they need and that they're actually fulfilling the sponsor responsibilities. So we think these are some gaps here in terms of the oversight of sponsors. Now, while the department doesn't approve the sponsors, it does approve the charter school applications.
Just a point on that, Ms. Randall, in that the department does not approve sponsors, but don't sponsors have to meet certain criteria, being one of the sponsoring agencies, and if a nonprofit, to have a certain balance. So as long as you meet those requirements, you can be a sponsor, period. Would that be correct?
Madam Chair, thanks. Yes, thanks for the clarification. Yeah, the department does make sure, and this is important to note, the department does make sure that the sponsor meets those requirements in law. So, right, that it is a higher education institution, that it is a nonprofit organization that has X amount in assets. But it doesn't look at the capacity of the organization in terms of fulfilling those oversight responsibilities of the sponsor.
But at this point, they are doing what they are required to do in that sense. It's just that they haven't gone beyond that in evaluating. That be a fair question or fair?
It's a fair question, sure. Madam Chair, I think that's fair. I mean, it's not explicitly spelled out in law that they should approve sponsors. We think that they probably have the authority to do this as the law is written, but it's not explicitly required of them.
Okay, very good. That clarifies it. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair,
they might
follow up.
Yes, Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Ms. Randall, you spoke of the expectations as delineated in statute. I'm wondering, is there anything expressly laid out of what happens to sponsors if they don't meet those expectations? And I'm not talking about repercussions on the part of the department, but when you sponsor an organization, a board, or a charter school, and they screw up, is there no egg on your face as a sponsor? What do you have to do? Are there any civil penalties, criminal penalties? Is a sponsor held to account for anything other than expectations?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't believe so. The department, I don't know, might want to step in on this one, but no, there's no penalties that would apply to a sponsor if a charter school failed, unless a sponsor themselves did something criminal, you know, directly criminal, but that would be handled separately. But in terms of the sponsor role and you're supposed to be overseeing a charter school, not that I'm aware of.
So you would say that there is no way that a sponsor could be considered a fiduciary?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't believe so. I might call on Assistant Commissioner Morgan Brown to jump in. He might have more information on that point.
Thank you.
If that's okay, Madam Chair.
Absolutely.
Morgan Brown with the Minnesota Department of Education. Madam Chair, Representative, no, that's correct. In the charter school law, the sponsors do not have legal liability for the actions of the boards of the charter school. So in terms of, and the reason for that is, the original sponsors were all school districts, and school districts were obviously reluctant to assume legal liability for charter schools that they authorized. And that is extended more broadly to sponsors in general. So the primary consequences, outside of the example that Ms. Randall mentioned of where they actually take an activity where there could be some kind of criminal investigation, et cetera, is that if they do a lousy job sponsoring, the department's not going to approve any more, allow them to authorize any further charter schools through the application process for the individual schools.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Brown. And we'll welcome you back later. All right, other questions? Please continue.
So we were talking about gaps and duplication. So the gaps are this oversight of sponsors. The duplication is that the department approves all charter school applications, but many sponsors also approve charter school applications. So when you have these sponsors, the sponsors who are heavily engaged, who do more oversight, they require charter schools that want to be sponsored by them to go through a pretty rigorous charter school application. So, you know, you're all a group of community members. You want to set up a charter school. You approach a sponsor and say, you know, hey, will you sponsor us? Many of these sponsors are going to say, okay, but you need to go through this long and involved charter school application process with us. that you all go through that. The sponsor says, yep, okay, we'll approve you, we'll authorize you. And then you have to go to the Department of Education and go through their whole big charter school application process again. And the department may or may not approve you, even though the sponsor has already approved you. So that's where the duplication comes in. You've got kind of a lot of re-going over the same material, if you will. So we have some recommendations regarding these gaps and these this duplication. Our main recommendation here is that we think the legislature needs to clarify the role of sponsors and the Department of Education. In the report, we lay out three different options to consider, but we really recommend one, which is option one in the report. And this is that the legislature should require the Department of Education to approve sponsors. So have a direct line over the sponsors. And then once a sponsor is approved, they have more authority. So then the sponsor can directly approve the charter school. So it's more of a streamlined, it's much clearer who's in charge of who and who's got the oversight responsibility. So you've got the department approving sponsors, the sponsors approving charter schools. Now, the department would still have oversight over the charter schools the way it does of all public schools, you know, regarding financial and regulatory compliance. But the department wouldn't have this kind of additional oversight layer of charter schools that it has for charter schools that it doesn't have for other schools. Now, for this to happen, the department would have to do some things, too. So we recommend that the department needs to implement standards for sponsors. Actually, the department has already developed some standards for sponsors, and there are some national standards for sponsors. So it's a matter of kind of finalizing them and firming them up and then actually requiring sponsors to meet them. As part of that, we think the department should provide training for the sponsors to help them get the expertise they need. In particular, we heard about sponsors wanting training on the financial expertise, the financial aspects. So the department would provide training for them. And then also we think the department needs to ensure that sponsors are meeting these standards on an ongoing basis. So without directly saying it, frankly, in the report, we're basically getting a kind of an accreditation process for sponsors, where every 3 to 5 years, sponsors would have to demonstrate that they've got the financial capacity, the understanding of, you know, academic performance, and that they're engaged in their oversight role. All right, I've thrown a lot at you. I'm going to keep moving forward, though, unless you want to stop and keep going. All right, so I'm going to move from talking about the department and the sponsors to now talking about the charter school board, because we also had some concerns, in particular about conflicts of interest that arise at the board level. Two big points. The conflict of interest laws for charter schools are weaker than the comparable federal requirements. And then the conflict of interest laws don't address potential conflicts of interest with sponsors. And this also gets a little detailed, so that we thought it would be best to put up this table and kind of walk everybody through it. So there's three sets of laws that apply to charter schools regarding conflict of interest. The first is the Minnesota Charter School Law. The second is the federal charter school law, which applies when a charter school is receiving federal funds. And this is typically in the first 3 years, and then it could be ongoing if they receive a facilities grant, for example. And then the Minnesota school district law regarding conflict of interest is incorporated by reference into the charter school board law. So that one also is relevant here for charter schools. So the first instance here is when a charter school board member is an employee of a for-profit organization that's providing services to the charter school. Everyone agrees that's a conflict of interest and is prohibited. If the charter school board member is an employee of a nonprofit organization that provides services to the charter school, the Minnesota Charter School Law does not prohibit this. It requires disclosure to the department about this relationship, but it's not prohibited. But it is prohibited by the federal law and then the Minnesota School District law. If an immediate family member of a charter school board member provides contracted services, only the federal charter school law says that's a conflict of interest. And then none of the laws address potential conflicts of interest with sponsors. And by that, we mean when a sponsor and a charter school enter into a relationship, a financial relationship that's separate from the charter school contract. So, for example, some charter schools lease facilities from their sponsor. And that could be a potential for conflict of interest there. So none of the laws address that. So kind of three big points to get out of this table. One, the laws are at odds with each other. Second, the federal charter school law is the strictest. And third, none of them address potential conflicts of interest with sponsors. Now, we do have some recommendations on this point, but before I get to them, I'm going to talk a little bit more about another issue with charter school boards, which is regarding the requirement that teachers comprise a majority of charter school board members. Minnesota is the only state that requires teachers to comprise the majority on charter school boards. This contradicts best practices for organizational governance. The Minnesota Council of Nonprofits states that no more than one staff person should be on the board of its organization. And, of course, charter schools are incorporated as nonprofits or cooperatives, so we think it's a relevant best practice. And also, it really leads to circular oversight. When we talk to people, you know, we heard them say, okay, so during the day, the director's in charge and, you know, oversees the director or oversees the teachers. And then that evening, they go to the board meeting, and now all of a sudden the teachers are overseeing the director. And it's really very circular. And then finally, it makes it difficult for charter schools to get the expertise they need on their board. They need financial expertise, legal expertise, governance expertise. I think the best illustration of this is one charter school we visited has five teachers. It's a very small school. By law, a charter school board has to have five members. Okay, so three of the members have to be teachers. You've got five teachers in the school. One of them is the director, can't be on the board. So three of the remaining, if you can follow my figures, three of the remaining four teachers have to be on the board, whether or not they want to. And frankly, we heard from some folks that, you know, the teachers don't necessarily want to be on the board, or they're burned out, or they don't have the expertise. They're great teachers. They might not necessarily be great, you know, board members. The school in particular expressed concern about how do they get all that expertise they need in those two remaining community spots. It just makes it hard for them. Now, by law, the charter school has to have this teacher majority in place by the end of its third year. But the schools can apply for waivers. And the numbers I have are a little old, but so between January of 2007 and June of 2008, so during that about 18-month period, the department approved 14 requests for the waivers. But the department denied 15 requests for the waivers. So even though in law this waiver is in place, it's not always granted. So then it's not always available. So we have some recommendations regarding all of this charter school board issues, all these issues. First, we think the legislature should expand the conflict of interest laws for charter schools to match the federal requirements. Those are the most strict requirements, and we don't think they should only apply when a school's receiving federal funds. We think it should apply all the time. Secondly, we think that the legislature should expand the conflict of interest laws to address those potential conflicts of interest with sponsors. Now, we don't necessarily say there can't be a relationship, but we do think that those should be disclosed to the department and entered into cautiously because it can complicate things. We also think that the legislature should remove the requirement that the school district conflict of interest law apply to charter schools. First, if you follow the first recommendation about adapting the federal one, you don't need it anyways because you're already covered. And secondly, having this in two different places makes it confusing. People aren't quite sure what they're supposed to follow, and we think if it's just in one spot, you'll get better compliance. And then finally, we think you should remove the requirement that teachers comprise the majority of charter school boards. We're not saying that teachers can't comprise the majority of charter school board members. We just don't think it should be required. And this is a recommendation we made in our 2003 evaluation of charter school financial accountability also, and we're making it again here today. And that's it for me. There's a letter at the back of the report with the department's comments on our recommendations. I think in the most part they support them, but I know that Assistant Commissioner Brown can come up here and speak to that himself. So that's the end of my formal presentation. I'm happy to take more questions. Thanks for your time.
You know, I know that the topic of this was oversight, and we've also talked about accountability. And a number of the questions that have come up regarding charter schools are questions that are coming from the public who are hearing reports and wondering, you know, where's the oversight here and where's the accountability to the taxpayer? Because our you know, traditional public school districts have a link to the public through the election of school board members. Mm-hmm. In your report, did you touch on where that accountability is to taxpayers? Because the department in this scenario is approving sponsors or else checking off that list and have oversight over charter schools. Mm-hmm. But where is there more public oversight? Have you seen that in other states, or did you study that at all?
Madam Chair, thanks for the question. That was not something that we really directly addressed in our report. That being said, I think that there's still that public accountability through the department. I think the sponsors are really entrusted with that. And frankly, several of the sponsors that I spoke with spoke about that, you know, felt very strongly that we are overseeing taxpayer money and we have a responsibility here. Now, needless to say, those were the ones that that were more involved and more engaged and would probably meet the standards that the department would set to approve sponsors, if you follow that line of reasoning. But a direct link back to the taxpayers, I think, would have to come through the Department of Education. Really, they're more directly accountable to their immediate community through their election of their charter school board, you know, through the families that go to the school and then the teachers there.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Are there other questions? Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another concern that I don't know that you could address, and I don't really see how you could, but, you know, in a time of limited resources, and particularly in some of our communities where there's been a lot of dissension within the community and families have chosen to pull their kids out of the public schools and they've started these charter schools, that has a direct impact on the quality of education for those left in the public schools, because now the declining enrollment, the funds are even more limited. Has there been any kind of research done on the impact on the public schools because of this matter?
Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, not that I'm familiar with. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, obviously. I think to find a link directly to the exodus of students, I think, would be difficult because, again, there's so many things happening in a school to be able to identify why exactly it's happening. You know, why exactly achievement or things are changing at a school district might be difficult. I guess one thought, and this doesn't necessarily answer your question, but just to say it, is that, you know, charter schools attract different families and different students for lots of different reasons. And some of them might not have been doing well in the district school. And so when they leave, you know, that might help the school. I don't know. I mean, that's a terrible thing to say. But do you know what I mean? I mean, there's lots of different reasons why people leave a district school. And some of them are, I don't know. I guess I shouldn't say anymore. So
I think that question, Senator Bonhoff, you know, the example I've used is that if a school district wants to do something innovative, they have to sell it to their public. They have to go to their school board and really have a public discussion about that. And the public can weigh in through their school board and through public meetings. And whereas in a charter school, and this can be you know, an opportunity, and this is the difference, is that if you have a small group of parents, and as you just said, the school board of that charter school is responsible to its families. And yet our public schools that are in our traditional school districts are not just accountable to the families in that school. We have seen that in, you know, communities across the state where when you have a community that has fewer children in school, like I have one community that has 50% of families have kids in public school and they're very engaged, whereas another community has like 30%. And so our school districts are reportable to the entire community. Now, that's an issue, is that we want all of our schools to be strong and be accountable to the people who are paying for them. So that's an issue that I don't have an answer for that, but I think it does reflect the difference in charter schools of, as you've mentioned, you're accountable to the families in your school versus another school that could be across the street equally as engaged, but they also have to report to the senior citizens in that community who question what's happening in that school. So there are other questions for Ms. Randall? Well, thank you. Maybe you'd like to stay close by just for a little bit in case something comes up. And if Morgan Brown would come forward from the Department of Education, and thank you for being with us tonight. And I know we had asked that if you would respond to some of the issues here, as well as if you feel prepared to talk about some of the issues that have come up over the interim, of things that maybe you've responded to either in light of this report or specific situations that have come up over the last summer. That would be great.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Morgan Brown with the Department of Education. For those of you that want to follow along, what I'm going to do is quickly summarize the Commissioner Segrin's official response to the report and its recommendations, and that can be found on page 73 in the back of the report. First of all, I want to start by saying that the department and the commissioner very much appreciates the work of Mr. Noble and the Office of Legislative Auditor staff in terms of the thorough review that was done in this report, especially with regards to charter school oversight. And I've heard a number of favorable comments from external stakeholders as well about the thoroughness of the report. My comments will be divided up into three areas. First, financial performance of charter schools. The department was very pleased that the OLA's analysis concluded that, quote, based on indicators related to year-end fund balances, charter schools' financial health is comparable to that of school districts, unquote. And the reason we were so pleased is that was a clear reversal of a trend that the OLA had found in an earlier report Ms. Randall referenced that was issued in 2003, but as a contrast, in 2007, now the percentage of charter schools in statutory operating debt or with a negative fund balance is actually slightly lower than the percentage of district schools in these categories. Moreover, as noted in the Legislative Auditor's Report, the percentage of the department's school finance awards given to charter schools has risen from 0% in 2003 to now 45% of those school awards in 2008. With regard to the recommendations on charter school oversight, as was mentioned, the department is generally supportive of all of the OLA's recommendations, and we stated in this official response back in June that we intended to work with stakeholders and legislators to see how those might be addressed during the 2009 session, and that is something that currently is in process. I'll briefly go through our response to the recommendations. Recommendation number one on the legislature clarifying the roles of the department and sponsors. With respect to charter school oversight, the department certainly felt that many aspects of that recommendation, particularly what is identified as option one under that recommendation, are worthy of consideration. And so we've been exploring with stakeholders and others about whether there might be consensus in terms of how to transition to that model. Related to that is recommendation number two, saying the department should implement standards for charter school sponsors and provide training for sponsors with regard to meeting those standards. The department did want to note that since 2004, we have implemented a number of projects and activities to improve the quality of sponsorship in Minnesota, including by setting essentially voluntary standards, which is the only thing we felt we had legislative authority to do, and primarily by disseminating information about effective sponsorship practices and providing for a variety of technical assistance training and resources for sponsors. And if you want to see a list of those activities, they're attached to this letter. But we certainly think that recommendation number two has merit, especially in combination with the first recommendation, and we would welcome any authority, rulemaking or otherwise, that would clearly give the department authority to set standards for sponsors as part of a process for approving sponsors specifically. On recommendation number three, about the department providing financial management training to board members and requiring all new charter board members attend financial management training within 1 year of being elected, again, we note that we have significantly expanded financial management training for charter school board members and directors since 2003, and a list of those activities is attached to the letter, but we very much support the recommendation because currently under the law, the department is required to provide the financial management training, but board members of charter schools are not required to attend it or attend any particular financial management training that might have been approved by the department. On recommendation number four, which was gone into with pretty thoroughly regarding the conflict of interest laws, we wholeheartedly support the recommendation, which is essentially to adopt the federal standards for conflict of interest for charter school board members. And finally, with recommendation number five about allowing teachers to be a majority of the board at a charter school but not requiring it, we continue to be supportive of that as we were after the 2003 report. And those of you that were at the last meeting of this working group, I believe, heard Senator Ember Reichscott-Young, one of the founders of the charter school law, speak pretty strongly about why she's in favor of that change as well. Finally, the third area we wanted to comment on was about academic performance of charter schools as addressed in the report. The OLA report found that charter schools have increased educational choices for Minnesota students, that's a quote, and that overall these schools are serving higher percentages of students of color, children from low-income families, and English language learners than district schools. And this is a significant confirmation in the department's opinion that collectively these schools are fulfilling an important purpose of the charter school law. Given the fundamental chartering concept is of increased school autonomy and flexibility in exchange for greater accountability, the department takes very seriously the measurement of academic performance in charter schools, and we do appreciate the OLA's efforts to account for a number of demographic and other factors in comparing academic performance in charter and district schools, as well as inclusion of several cautionary statements regarding interpretation of this analysis. While the OLA's evaluation of academic performance certainly provides a basis for further inquiry, the department cautions that it is difficult to infer any causal relationship between students' enrollment in a charter or district school and those students' academic results using 1 year's worth of data. It tells you something about the performance of the students in that school on state assessments. It doesn't necessarily tell you anything about the school performance because you don't have any growth measurement. And this goes back to a question that I believe Senator Bonhoff has raised. It has really been a priority for the department to provide student assessment data that will allow more sophisticated evaluations of a school's impact on student academic performance over time. As MD implements a growth model for measuring student progress on the MCA 2 exams. And for charter schools specifically to allow this, earlier this year we signed a shared data agreement with the highly respected Center for Research on Education Outcomes, known as CREDO, at Stanford University, which has a lot of experience in doing these kind of evaluations in multiple states. And under the shared data agreement, their researchers will be provided access to the student data necessary to conduct a multi-year longitudinal study of students' academic performance in charter schools as compared to the performance of similar students in district schools. So it would actually be quasi-experimental in terms of that comparison. And our hope is to get that going. As Ms. Randall mentioned, that there was a difficulty in that we had a change in the assessment. But after the assessments this year, we will have the baseline data for the MCA2s plus 3 years of additional data. And the general consensus among experts in the field is you want at least 3 years of growth to analyze. And so once we have the 2009 data, CREDO will be able to begin working on that evaluation. And it will be, I think it's fair to say, the most comprehensive and rigorous evaluation of students' longitudinal growth performance in charter schools as compared to their peers in district schools. So we look forward to sharing that with you.
Thank you.
And I'd be happy to take any questions.
You know, on your point, I think earlier we were talking about where is the accountability to the public, and it's with the Department of Education. Could you comment with some of the recommendations that are here? We've heard some very disturbing stories over the past 6 months, some of them with alleged reports of fiscal mismanagement, licensure of teachers. How is it that we had to depend on the news media to bring those to our attention? And was there something within our current laws that prevented the department from discovering these situations so that, we are relying on the public to dig these stories up? And that's unfortunate because once it happens, then there's a sense of mistrust.
Right.
So what might have been done differently so that the department could have had a better handle on that?
Right. Madam Chair, I think the OLA's recommendations really are relevant to this in that we always often talk about charter schools essentially having a triple accountability framework. They are accountable under all the same laws that public schools are accountable under, including for academic performance and meeting the standards and having to comply with the requirements for adequate yearly progress. They also have accountability to their sponsor under the terms in the contract, which can be much more specific in terms of various kinds of academic goals and other goals, in addition to the AYP framework. And then third, as we talked about, they're accountable to their school community, not only in terms of the elections that were referenced of board members, but in terms of the fact that these are all as schools of choice. These students are only there because their families want them there, and if the families are unhappy, they can take their business elsewhere, which will mean that the money leaves the school as well. So with regard to some of the concerns that have come up, the department has been very forceful in responding to those concerns with any authority that we've had, but I think it does speak to the importance of clarifying the roles of the sponsor and the department and perhaps strengthening the hand of sponsors in a number of different ways to provide oversight to schools as well. And that requires both a partnership between the department and sponsors, but also requires sponsors to feel that their responsibilities are clearly identified so that there's no confusion on their end. And there's a lot of discussion about that in the report.
First question from Representative Abler and then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Brown, welcome back. And just to piggyback on Senator Bonhoff's question about the student I'm glad she picked up on that. It just jumped out right away at me. That the study you're doing, which I think is great, is that going to be student-based, tracking one student for several years, or school-based?
Right, individual students. So we'll track using, again, as Senator Bonhoff, why can't we do this using the MARS data? The answer is we can, and they will actually be tracking individual students.
Okay. Outstanding. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. And Senator Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. You do have the authority, the department does have the authority, Mr. Brown, to cancel contracts based on a couple of criteria. Have you ever come close to that or taken steps along that line? Or I don't know if you've exercised it at all.
Right.
And why or why not?
Madam Chair and Senator, the department has the authority. It's more limited than the authority of a sponsor to terminate a contract in the middle of that contract. We can potentially terminate a contract over even without the sponsor taking action for multiple violations of law or I believe the term is something like multiple instances of financial mismanagement. So they're in two instances, so it's more limited than the authority given to sponsors. It is unusual, hope, and this was the intent, that the commissioner would exercise that, because the only case where we would exercise it is where we felt the school needed to close right away and the sponsor was refusing to take any action, because essentially you're taking action over the heads of the sponsor. In most of the cases that have come up, the sponsor has taken action, and in addition, it can take action more quickly than the department, because the department, if we were to terminate a contract, we're required to do a public hearing process under Chapter 14, which is a multiple-month process, whereas a sponsor can do it within 60 days, and if it's a real crisis, a board of a charter school could actually close the school instantly. So we have the ability to do it in extreme circumstances if the sponsor refuses to take action, but it's not a quick process for us under current law.
Thank you.
Okay, and then a question from Representative Simon and Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for coming here today. I'm interested in hearing from you and potentially from Ms. Randall a little bit more on the accountability piece. First of all, full disclosure, I was on the founding board of a charter school, so I'm a fan of the movement in general, but these headlines over in the past few years about embezzlement, outright criminality, mismanagement are very disturbing to me. And should be to everyone, and it seems to me that the problems fall into two basic categories. One is a competence problem, and one is just a conscience problem. Some of these recommendations will address the competence problem, more training, et cetera, maybe more oversight. But if there's a crook out there who sees a charter school as a great way to embezzle $100,000, I don't know that any training is really going to dissuade that person from being a crook. And maybe this is an unfair question, but have you thought about that category? How can we better clamp down on the conscience problem, not just the competence problem of good-meaning, well-meaning friends and neighbors who get together and find themselves either in over their head or maybe just making a simple mistake as compared to crooks,
right,
stealing?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I mean, the department shares the strong concern that has come up about those instances where there is, it's not just an issue of financial mismanagement, but there's either fraud or allegations of fraud or embezzlement. To put that in context, there have been only two of those cases, to my knowledge, where there has been criminal efforts, either allegations or at this point or a criminal indictment for that kind of financial embezzlement, but it's very disturbing nonetheless. And I think, again, where this speaks to is, and it does overlap with the OLA's recommendations, a key piece of this is having strong board training for charter school boards, because a charter school board that is exercising appropriate authority over a school director and any other employees will catch that kind of even financial mismanagement they should catch, but they should certainly catch any kind of criminal activity. And so I think that speaks to the importance of both sponsors and the department and others ensuring that there is strong board training for boards of charter schools.
Well, just to follow up, Madam Chair, would you then support or do you think there would be support out there for somehow making sure that the sponsors have a little more skin in the game, so to speak, where there's some culpability, if not sort of one-to-one responsibility, I suppose, for financial mismanagement? Do you think that's the way to go, or is that too punitive, or would that dissuade well-meaning sponsors from getting involved for fear that they're going to be on the hook for an embezzler?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the department would want to look at a specific proposal and see how it's referenced. If we were to move to something like the legislative auditor suggested, a model of where we were approving sponsors directly and in the process perhaps approving, therefore, the sponsor fees that they that they generate from sponsoring schools under the law, there might be some authority that given to the state to withhold those fees if the sponsor wasn't doing its duty. So some kind of something that's parallel to what we can do with schools. I would be very cautious on the issue of going down the path of having sponsors be legally liable for the actions of board. I think of boards of charter schools. I think, first of all the school districts would get out of the sponsoring business for sure, and I don't know about the other sponsors, but to open yourself up to those kind of, that kind of litigation, I think would be potentially a problem.
There are the financial disclosure issues I think we've talked about, and to look at what we require of many school board members, especially in the metro area, who have to fill out a financial disclosure statement like all of us at this table do, and how does that work with sponsors who are in some ways serving in that same capacity, might be worthy of just discussion or else looking at perhaps a little bit more. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Brown. In your letter to Mr. Nobles, dated June 24th, you discuss the significant increase in the school finance awards given to charter schools. What do you attribute that to?
I guess a couple different things, Madam Chair, Representative. One is the start of those school finance awards coincided with the report from the legislative auditor and the recommendations, and that coincided with our stepping up our efforts with regard to financial training for board members and schools as well, including a lot of customized training. So as a result, we've been providing much more hands-on training, and there's been others outside of the department who have as well, to charter school boards. And then I also think it was just with that 2003 report that came out from the auditor, just a greater awareness on the charter school community among charter school boards that this was a real deficit that needed to be addressed. So it was a number of things that came together that I think led to them taking this more seriously.
Thank you.
And Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Brown, the OLA identified several problems that they've made recommendations for and you've responded to. I was wondering if there are any other problems that you have identified that you think need to be addressed as well.
Madam Chair, Representative, the department is in the process of drafting legislation in this area, and there's probably other stakeholders that are drafting legislation as well. I'm a little reluctant to comment on specifics until that legislation is finalized, which it will be soon, but I guess suffice it to say, to the extent that we're trying to address the recommendations here that the OLA has addressed in statute, we certainly want to use the opportunity to clean up other language that probably should be cleaned up. One which I'm comfortable mentioning because it's been talked a lot about before is bringing greater clarity to the whole provision in the charter school law that differs between a sponsor terminating or not renewing a charter school's contract for cause, as you know, one of the causes specified in the law, as opposed to when a sponsor says, what we currently call voluntary non-renewal, which isn't a very good term, but where a sponsor says, I'm getting out of the business of sponsoring, I don't want to sponsor your school anymore, but I'm not renewing your contract because I think you've done something wrong. And we think that language could be made much tighter so that sponsors would feel empowered to take the appropriate action.
Okay. And Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Since Brown, Board of Education by the Supreme Court, tens and hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent, invested to promote integration, equal opportunity. We've made progress, and you know, November 6th indicated that as well. I'm troubled with the fact that we do allow segregated schools in the charter model. And we're going to hear some convincing testimony from people that say why that can provide hope as well for people of color. But is this an issue by the Department of Education, which spends $100 million or so now in various programs on integration? And then within the same department, you know, through legislative action, we allow segregation in public schools.
Madam Chair, Senator, I appreciate the question. Of course, the department oversees the school choice programs, and we've probably been the most progressive state in school, with regard to providing education options for all families. We have a 20-plus year history with post-secondary enrollment options and open enrollment and charter schools and online learning. And we also oversee the integration law and the desegregation rule as well. And I think our general policy is that all families should have a number of education options, and all families for whom it is this is important as a priority, should have the option of choosing a school that has an integrated student population, as they would choose to define that. And certainly there is, under the DSEG rule, the opportunity to promote voluntary integration efforts with the DSEG rule and the and integration revenue. I would be cautious. I know you're going to hear about a report, and I'd be happy to comment on that more specifically later if you want me to. I guess I would be cautious about equating the kind of self-selection that happens in a choice environment where families are actively choosing a particular school to the de jure, de facto segregation of the past, which didn't necessarily involve the individual parent choice. And then in addition, I guess I would also be cautious on just trying to address whatever concerns there are with regard to charter schools and schools of choice through the mechanisms that are available currently under the DSEG rule in dealing with school districts for two reasons. One is I think there's some unintended consequences and impacts that need to be thought through because charter schools really were never intended to be under the DSEG rule. But secondly, the department has expressed concerns about the DSEG rule as it currently exists. And, in fact, the OLA had a whole report in 2005 with a series of recommendations that we completely supported at that time. And so the idea of adding a bunch of new schools into a rule that we feel in concert with the OLA's report could use some improvement may be not advisable at this point.
Well, I think on that point, though, Mr. Brown, that, you know, one of the questions that this is a very difficult decision, like discussion, and I know that in a Senate hearing last year in Senator Stump's committee, as we talked about charter schools, we really haven't had a discussion as a legislature about culture-specific schools. Mm-hmm. And how does that fit into the original intent of charter schools? And I think it's troubling to some of us to read that in some of the schools that have been in the paper recently, discussion of, well, children only feel comfortable if they're in a culture-specific school. And that is not probably the direction that we hope our schools are going. And as a parent, you can talk about choice and that, you know, this is a parent's choice to send a child to a culture-specific school. Well, when my children wanted to go to a school, I was told they couldn't go there because there were too many white children. So I didn't have my choice, and that's not what is driving my. But I just say that we're sort of going down a different road now, and it's a discussion that we haven't had, and I hope we can have it in a very thoughtful way so that we find common ground and find peace and comfort on this issue because it's something that I think needs to be discussed because I think the public is also, again, asking, are we starting to segregate our children again? And is that the direction that we believe that we should be going with our public dollars? So I understand the choice issue, but it raises some other question as well.
And, Madam Chair, if I just briefly respond, I think it does deserve a full discussion. It gets into a lot of the issues that Ms. Randall referenced and that there are a bunch of complicated reasons why parents choose one school over another. Mm-hmm. It is not kind of a single-minded process in their minds. It's a number of things that they factor in that we probably need to be conscious of. And the specific example you raise, that would no longer be allowed under the recent Supreme mm-hmm. Court decision that says you cannot do schools by race, essentially, or attendance or enrollment by race. So that
right.
shouldn't be allowed in the future,
right.
but I hear where the concern's coming from. And I know you have some other...
But all our schools should be welcoming to all children is what I'm trying to get at.
Right.
So,
right.
Are there other questions? And Senator Erickson Rope.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wonder if you could talk for a moment about the sponsor conflicts. I have heard some stories floating around that gives me reason to believe that there are some opportunities for sponsor conflicts. But I don't understand a lot about it. And could you give us a few examples of some of the things you've come to learn that exist out there and how specifically we might deal with them? And then in the recommendation to deal with them, are we doing something broad or something very specific? And what kind of conflicts are we talking about?
Madam Chair, Senator, I'll be happy to respond, and then the legislative auditor staff may wish to add something as well based on their review. Their recommendation is actually not to prohibit any kind of relationships between sponsors and schools outside of the charter contract, but that there needs to be full disclosure of them. And furthermore, that we probably should have language that makes clear that sponsors cannot, as a condition of sponsorship for schools, say you must use us for certain types of services, kind of conditioning you're only going to be allowed to exist if you use us as a vendor for certain areas. And we totally agree with all those recommendations. I don't know that we've had any examples to date that I'm aware of a major conflict of interest for a sponsor and a school where it's kind of come to our attention as a complaint. There are some situations where you could see how it might be legitimate that a school would want to utilize a sponsor in certain ways. For instance, if a sponsor is a school district and has vacant facilities that they would like to lease to the charter school and receive lease payments, that would be an example. If the charter school would like to contract with the school district for providing certain special ed services that the school district can provide because of its economy of scale, but the charter school, you know, for low instance situations as well, that would be probably an advantage to the charter school. So we certainly want to prohibit them outright, but we want to make clear it should not be a condition of the contract, and there does need to be full disclosure to the department.
Senator Chair, one follow-up. Related to that, the example that I had been told about is that there was a school district that was thinking of outpricing or really raising the rent in terms of the lease agreement that they had with the charter school because it was one of these rural schools that got closed. The rural school chartered up and stayed there, and the school district wasn't happy. And, you know, they were the sponsor, and they were leasing the school from them, and there was discussion in the community whether they should just raise the rent and force them out, that sort of thing. So, you know, I see that kind of thing as a potential conflict of interest, too, from the sponsors. There been any discussion about how charter schools may be protected from being manipulated like that?
Madam Chair and Senator, the way we would hope to catch that in all situations is there is actually an application process for schools that want to get lease aid than to use, obviously, to pay the lease for their facilities. And one of the criteria in which we go through in terms of approving lease aid is the lease amount reasonable for the market in that area? So if we had a situation where especially a rural charter school came to us and all of a sudden they've got a rent that's jacked up way beyond what that space would normally be, particularly in that area, we would raise questions and may not even approve the lease aid. So that's hopefully how we would catch it. But I understand your point, which is, especially in a rural area where there be maybe minimal other options for facilities, that a charter school that was sponsored by that district might feel a little bit captive in that situation.
You know, on that topic of the lease aid and also facilities, I would like to see this group have a hearing on just facilities, which will lead to that discussion of lease aid, because I think that a number of the issues that we've heard about or are at least I'm hearing about as, you know, a co-chair of this group, you know, does link to that. And so I hope that maybe after we're back in session that, you know, we can have let's hear what's going on, let's hear some of the issues, and then let's find the solution to that. So I think that even though it is a finance issue and we are a policy group, I think we've been given permission to have that discussion here. And so we have some people who have some background in that area. So I think that will be coming up then, and I really appreciate that. But I know there is an issue with lease aid, and like recently in the paper we heard of three school districts or of three schools being for sale in Minneapolis. And there's an issue, too, of where lease aid is a very significant part of our education budget, and we just want to look at that thoughtfully as we move forward in a very it's going to be a challenging year for us, so we're going to look at that responsibly. So any other questions? I'd like to move on, and certainly this is a working group, so we're going to have some more discussions on this, and I know that as questions come up in our next hearing, Representative Slocum is chairing that, it will be looking at many of the proposals coming forward from a number of different stakeholder groups. So this is sort of background so that as we hear the proposals, we can perhaps kind of start, you know, checking off these proposals would address some of these concerns that are being brought up. So thank you very much, Mr. Brown, for being here today. We're going to move to public testimony, and Myron Orfield, who is a former senator, a state senator, and now is the director of the Institute on Race and Poverty at the University of Minnesota Law School, will be here to talk with us about a report that came out last week. And I think that even though there is some controversy about this report, I think it's important for us to hear it again in light of the fact that we're going to be hearing some different proposals from groups next week.
Take it for what you want. I know there are some people here who want to challenge that. I do believe that this report and maybe others will be heard at another time with a more full hearing. This is sort of a briefing for us. And I just want to welcome you here today, Mr. Orfield.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering, I can't remember the etiquette of the Senate, but is it appropriate to have people join me at the table?
I think that would be just fine. As long as you stay kind of in your time frame, that would be great.
Yes,
absolutely.
Would like to
please introduce them as well.
I would like to introduce them. I have Tom Luce, who is the research director at the Institute on Race and Poverty. Tom has a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania in public policy. Second, I have Barish Gumas-Dawes, principal researcher on this report. Barish has a PhD from Yale University in sociology. They did a great deal of the number crunching on this report, so if there are methodological questions, I'd like to have them available, Madam Chair.
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the purpose of this study, it came about, it's a companion study to another one that we did about growing segregation in the public schools in the Twin Cities. The public schools of the Twin Cities have moved from about 8 segregated schools in the late 1990s to more than 108 today. One of the things we found in our first study, in the initial study, was that charter schools were part of this increasing segregation that was occurring in the metropolitan area. They were influencing this to occur. We're not saying in this report that the segregated public schools are doing a good job. We're not. We're saying that the segregated charter schools are making the public schools more segregated, and they're doing worse. We'd like to bring the conversation about charter schools back to the goals that were originally set out. Ted Coldery, I saw, was here in the audience today, and I remember some of the soaring rhetoric about charter schools at the beginning. They were to improve the performance of students. One of the specific goals of charter schools was to make the schools more integrated. They were to serve as a tool to integrate the public schools. They were supposed to challenge the public schools to do a better job, to challenge the public schools to be better, to improve the public schools by a strong form of competition. We found that after 2 decades of experience, most charter schools in the Twin Cities still underperform the public schools at a given rate of poverty, that they intensify racial and social segregation in the region. Charter schools create competition in ethnic niches that triggers further segregation in the traditional public school system, which is rapidly increasing. A lower percentage of elementary school students in the charter schools were proficient in reading and math compared to public schools that attended comparable public schools. For reading proficiency, the average difference is nearly 9 percentage points in the charter schools, 9 percentage points below. For math, the average difference is nearly 10 percentage points. Suburban schools, we also compared suburban schools that were participating in the Choice Is Yours program, which is a pilot program, and we found that they outperformed the traditional public schools and the charter schools as well. Now, we're talking about schools as a whole in this particular study. Now, I bring you to the we're moving through this presentation, and chart 11 in this presentation shows a regression analysis. And the chart 11 says poverty and reading proficiency rates in Twin Cities elementary schools 2007 to 2008. And in this graph, which the statistical analysis was done by Tom and Barish Dawes, we see that we have two measures. We have one side that shows the percentage of students proficient in reading is one axis, and the other axis across the bottom is the percentage on free and reduced cost lunch. We have in this map the traditional public schools are triangles. They are dark triangles, and you can see the relationship between poverty and test scores in this. The charter schools are diamonds, are red diamonds, and most of them you can see that are below the line. The line that goes along there, as you can see, as the schools become that are 100% middle income, you can see the schools are much higher performing. As you go down to the higher poverty rates, you see lower performing schools. At almost every level, the charter schools underperform the public schools. Now, there are charter schools that are above the line. There just aren't very many, and they're not very far. Most of them are below the line. And you'll probably hear a lot from the ones that are above the line. What is important to realize is that there are more below the line, and they may not be here today. And you should make sure that when you visit the charter schools, you should visit some that are below the line. Some are at zero. And you should take a look at some of the ones that are zero as well as the ones that are above the line. We look at math in Charter 12, and you'll see, again, charter schools underperforming the predicted rate of achievement in the public schools. Charter schools have a tendency to concentrate students in non-white segregated schools. If you look at Chart 3, you'll look at the charter schools and the percentage of kids that are black that are in segregated settings. We look at 1995, in 2002, in 2005, and 2008, and you'll see that in the charter schools, 89% of the children are in segregated settings. The traditional public schools, 38%, and you can see the numbers over the years. You can see Latino kids increasing in segregated settings in both the traditional and charter schools. And you can see the kids that are non-white and of other minorities as well. Charter schools are even more.
Question for Senator Olson, if we could just have a
yes.
question.
Yes,
yeah. Sir Orfield, what did you try to find out why that is the case? I mean, you're seeming to infer that just because they're charters that they're doing this, but why has this occurred?
Segregation is a multifaceted problem, and it's caused by discrimination in housing markets. It's caused by things like real estate steering and mortgage lending discrimination, but it also is important in how public schools are formed and what kind of choices that they have, what kind of choices kids have. Sometimes you'll have schools that arise in a neighborhood, and you can see some of the maps. I handed out some of the maps. You'll see, for example, the Nova Classical Academy in St. Paul. You'll see that this is a school that is very largely white, and you'll see next to them, you'll see Higher Ground Academy, which I think you're going to hear from later today. In these schools, in integrated neighborhoods, they have requirements. They will give kids tests, or they'll have admissions interviews or parental involvement requirements. These are about choices, but choices are different for different kids. The closest parallel that I can think of is in Virginia. When Virginia had segregated schools in the 1960s, they offered private school academies, and the Virginia Supreme Court thought that that wasn't a permissible activity. They offered a choice program, and they said in a segregated setting, they said that African-American kids could come to the white schools or that white kids could come to the African-American schools. And the Supreme Court in the Green case, Green versus New Kent County Board of Education, said that's a great burden to place on an individual student to integrate a school district.
Madam Chair, Mr. Orfield, you're seeming to say that some of the schools are actually attracting away the white students, but the evidence here is that there's higher concentrations of other minorities in the charter schools. So I'm not sure I understand why you're making that distinction and highlighting ones that you feel maybe are attracting white students when you say that the public schools are less segregated, which I would think would be the opposite outcome of what your statement is, rather than the other way around. And if parents, I mean, did you determine that there's some heavy recruitment to try to keep the minorities? Because those families are making a choice too. And generally, the choice would be made if they aren't feeling that their student is being served in their existing school. That would seem to be the most powerful part of it. And I think the greatest challenge, both for our public schools and what we're trying to do with policy, as well as what charter schools are trying to find a way to serve students that are not now being served in the in the public system?
So maybe a brief answer, and then let's get through the report. And then we'll come back and take some more questions.
Public schools are racially segregated for a variety of reasons. Some have to deal with discrimination in the housing market. Some have to do with the placement of low-income housing, and some have to do with the way that schools draw boundaries. There are a variety of reasons. Charter schools, why are they causing segregation? In some cases, they move into neighborhoods where children are going to public schools that are doing very badly and promise them that they'll do better. And they say that a race-specific education can be a way to have that happen. And children that are not doing well in public schools go to those schools because they're not doing very well. But the evidence that we've shown here suggests that this other choice that they have is worse. So they have a very bad situation, and this is one that provides a worse one. The other part of this puzzle is that sometimes in places in the cities or the suburbs where the schools are becoming racially integrated, a charter school open that has admissions requirements or interviews or protocols that seem to allow, that seem to create a situation where the white children in those neighborhoods go to these schools and not the children of color. So I guess the choices are a complicated thing, and you have to come to terms with what kind of choices that you think are good ones. But these choices seem to be intensifying the problems that exist rather than making them less so. And I'd be happy to continue.
Yes. And a question from Mr. Slocum.
Madam Chair, I just want to reiterate the charter schools are public schools because it's been said over and over. I've heard it in a variety of places in this room today that the charters are different from public schools. They're not. They're public schools. And that that when parents make that choice, they do it for a variety of reasons. We come back to that. And we need to meet the needs of the kids. We're not. Our dropout rate's embarrassing. What we do with our black children is embarrassing. We're not succeeding. And I think to try and succeed with different populations certainly makes sense to me. And I think that's what we're trying to do here with this. In many cases, I'd like to look at longitudinal data. And what the other thing I would like to see is kids that go, like in an open enrollment situation where they move out to, let's say, they're Minneapolis students. And I'm a Minneapolis teacher, and I know, you know, we're bleeding students out to the suburbs. They go out to Hopkins. How long that student stays in Hopkins, and when that student doesn't succeed in Hopkins, where does that kid go? Generally speaking, my money's on a charter, because their traditional district didn't serve them well. They tried an open enrollment situation. Do kids that actually go out there, because my experience in Minneapolis as a Minneapolis teacher has been it doesn't work real well over the long term.
Madam Chair, there's nothing about this report that suggests that segregated public schools are doing a great job. It suggests and looks at data that shows that charter schools overall at this point in time are doing a worse job, and that very often kids that are marketed and told that if they move into race-specific education that they can do a better job, but the data suggests that in general that this is doing a worse job. It's a hard problem. I think that kids that come from really severely deprived backgrounds and are in really severely deprived conditions, this is a really hard problem. And there aren't any simple solutions to this, but I think one of the clear outcomes is after 20 years that these charter schools seem to be doing a worse job than the public schools, and the public schools aren't doing a great job.
Is it possible to get through the whole report and then we'll have some more questions, because we may not get through the whole report, and I'd like to at least, and maybe quickly through the rest of the report?
Sure.
Because I think that the people at the table have looked at this report quite a bit already, but I really appreciate you being here.
Yes. I think we've gone over many of these points, but they are even more segregated, racially segregated, than the already segregated traditional public schools. And if we're looking at some of the slides, you can take a look at the charter schools. For example, in the St. Paul, white children in segregated settings, there aren't any in the public schools. There are in this situation, the percentage of white students in segregated settings is 51% in the charter schools. And black kids, you can see 85% in the charter schools, 71% in the public schools, Latinos 72%, 71%. You can see in each ethnic group, these are more pronounced. And if you take a look at the maps that I provided, you can see a graphic depiction. These are the racial compositions of each of the schools. So you can see in many cases how they are next to each other. Now, these are interesting questions. Mr. Brown talked about Brown versus Board of Education and the implications, and Green versus New Kent County Schools of Virginia. A long time ago, or at least at some point, it was thought that the public schools shouldn't be racially segregated, that separate wasn't an equal thing, and that kids in the same neighborhood that live in the same neighborhood shouldn't be going to racially separate schools. You see this fairly frequently in the charter context, particularly in St. Paul and many of the suburbs in Apple Valley, in Plymouth. In many of the communities, you see these charter schools arising, and you have different schools by race in these neighborhoods. These are questions that I think you should deal with as a committee and think about.
Mr. Orfield, we're about at 15 minutes, but I know there's been a number of questions for you, okay. And so that other people have time for questions, are there any other main points you'd like to make in the report? And I know that there will be an opportunity to go into this in more depth at another time, but...
I think that we made the major points. I think that one of the things to think about is the fact that the charter schools are exempt from the state desegregation rule. In 11 states in the United States, charter schools are subject to the same civil rights requirements that the public schools are. So it's not a universal thing, but in 11 states of the country, the charter schools are subject to the same rules. In South Carolina and Nevada, they are actually subject to more stringent rules than the public schools. This is one of the things many years ago when charters were founded, they were supposed to encourage racial integration. They were supposed to be a spur to more integrated schools. This is one of the purposes of charter schools. In addition to challenging the public schools to do better, they were supposed to challenge the public schools to be more integrated. And in places like South Carolina and Nevada, there's some effort to do that. So it doesn't have to be that they're exempt from all civil rights rules. And them being exempt from civil rights rules exacerbates the problem. In many of the public school situations, public schools have been moving to more race-specific schools to mirror the charter schools. When the charter schools have a race-specific school in Minneapolis, Minneapolis needs to open an Afrocentric academy. Or St. Paul, in challenge to a charter school opening a Hmong academy, needs to open its own Hmong academy. Now, in most situations, these single-race schools are underperforming the more integrated schools. There are a few over the line, but in general, they tend to be. And this is perhaps a race to the bottom rather than a race to the top. And certainly the Minneapolis race-specific ethnocentric school is not doing remarkably well, but there's an increasing move to make more of them.
Very good. Thank you. First, Representative Simon Hornstein, and then Senator Bono.
Thanks for coming. Appreciate it. Members, this was my professor 14 years ago in the fall of 1994 at the University of Minnesota Law School, so thank you.
Well, thank you. Wonderful.
It was a great experience. No, thank you for coming, and... But I do have a question, you know, the common data question of causation versus correlation. Mm-hmm. What you're talking about here is correlation, not causation, right? I mean, it's like the old study that shows the top voting states are Minnesota, Maine, and North Dakota, causing one social scientist to say distance from Canada causes, you know, voting participation to rise, that there's some magnetic force field or something like that. Of course, we know that's not true. It's a correlation. These things correlate with performance. But you're not suggesting, are you, nor does your report show any support for causation, that because they're in charter schools, they do worse. You're saying that the results correlate with certain performance later. Isn't that true?
Madam Chair, wonderful student and a wonderful technique of cross-examining. I think that this is a question. In the Keyes versus Metropolitan Denver School District, the Supreme Court and Justice Powell in particular suggested that when boundaries are drawn that create incentives and patterns for kids to move, that this is a part and parcel, that the drawing of boundaries and the shaping of attendance areas and the way that kids draw on this, that these can have effects. When you have a school in St. Paul, the Nova Classical Academy, where the kids otherwise in the public schools would be going to integrated schools, and more of the white kids are signing up for this school and not the African American kids, is this causation? Is this an intent? I think these are questions you need to examine. Or when Apple Valley integrates one of its elementary schools and a largely white charter arises in the middle and draws kids into that school, these are questions a lot like the public schools and a lot like the intent. There are many studies that we cited where people, scholars in different parts of the country, said that the emergence of classical academies or specialized ethnic niche schools intensified the patterns in the public schools. Certainly the public schools in the papers in Minneapolis and St. Paul has said that they need to move toward more ethnic-specific schools to compete for what, quote-unquote, market share with the charters in terms of the number of kids. Whether these are invidious, intentional actions or whether they are factual predicates toward deeper segregation, I think, is a question.
Just quickly, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. For the performance,
and you are, for the record, just state your name.
I'm sorry, I'm Tom Luce. I'm the research director at the
Institute of Race. Speak into the mic too.
Yes. I'm Tom Luce. I'm the research director on the Institute of Race and Poverty. For the performance modeling, I would say that there is an implicit model underlying those statistics that say that there is some relationship between the characteristics of a school and what's going on in the school and the performance of the students in the school. So that analysis isn't purely a correlation model. That's a model that says that you set the model up to say that the characteristics of the school influence the outcomes in the school. And there's a lot of research that says that peer composition in schools has a large impact on how students do in schools. And so there, for the performance modeling, for the integration and segregation issues, that's a different question. But for the performance modeling, there is an implicit model here of causation that the characteristics of the school and the way the school operates does have an impact on how students perform on these tests. So I just wanted to say that. It isn't purely a correlation model here. The things that you put into this model are the kinds of things that the research say influence how well students perform on these kinds of tests.
Very quickly,
Madam Chair, my only follow-up is an open-ended question to Senator Orfield or either of the others of you. What should we do about this? Do you think, in your view, are charter schools beyond repair? Would you favor repealing the charter law? Do you think we should abolish them? Or do you think either the suggestions we've heard about today or others will suffice? Ban or repair?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Orfield.
I think that at a minimum that the charter schools should be subject to the same civil rights requirements that the public schools are. And I think that you have to take a searching examination of whether you're going to make it as easy to have race-specific schools and their effects on the public schools nearby. I think it's really important to see how they're affecting the public schools and how they're affecting those neighborhoods. I think looking at the Office of the Legislative Auditor's recommendations seem all good to me. And it also seems that if 11 states can require some civil rights guidance, I think this would be a positive thing.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Well, I'll save you some time, Madam Chair, because my question was similar to Representative Simon's. First to thank Senator Orfield and all of you for this. This is excellent, and I really appreciate your work on this. And I guess my question was, what would you suggest? And you've stated a couple of times having the charter schools be subject to the same civil rights requirements. You've expressed some support for the OLA.
recommendations in general. Anything else beside those two recommendations, Senator Orfield, that you would advise us to do?
I think that it's important in the context of the rapid increase in segregation in the public schools that there is a workable and strong desegregation rule that the Department of Education is implementing. One of the problems are that there are very few standards for civil rights that exist in the public schools, and they're diminishing. And you see the boundary decisions that are occurring in many of the suburban districts. You see the increase in segregation in many parts of the region. It's a moving target. And so I think strengthening the underlying state approach to this proposal and ensuring that the public schools can be more integrated and making sure that charter schools aren't making the situation worse, I think, is do no harm. But they're both interdependent. It's hard if you're moving on soft sand to build a strong foundation, and the state desegregation rule is very soft sand.
And Senator Bonhoff, and then I think we'll move on to our next.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Senator Wieger.
Oh, okay, Senator Bonhoff. Senator Orfield, thank you for your testimony and thank you for your work. And I appreciate that you're doing what you're doing based on your commitment to all kids, you know, being able to perform and have an excellent, outstanding, equal education. And I think that's why we're really all here. You know, that's why we sit on this committee. And so having said that, you know, I take your comments with that, but I think that you're missing something here because, you know, my kids go to Hopkins schools or went. I only have one left in school. And when they first started, there were mostly white kids in those schools. And, you know, right now there's a lot of racially isolated schools mm-hmm. there. We just closed one, and it's becoming more and more that way. And I represent part of Robbinsdale, and they have several racially isolated schools.
Yes.
And I've seen the demographic trends that are happening in our community. And, you know, when we talk about integration, what is integration? Does that mean there's equal white kids to kids who aren't white? Well, it's not going to be that way in our state. We have a changing, diverse population. So what is our definition of integration? And how can we hold the state accountable for that when we don't decide who moves into a neighborhood? And so I think that right now we all agree we haven't discovered how to effectively educate these changing faces in our schools, and we're failing. You know, we're succeeding on many things, but we're failing with our kids of color, our minorities, our English language learners. And I remember, because I've heard Ms. Randall's report before, that the one place she thought that we were succeeding was actually in Minneapolis. That was the one place where those charter schools were outperforming their public schools, and that wasn't really talked about today, but I do remember it. And so I would just say that I hear you. I read your reports. I'm not sure I draw the same conclusions. I think we have trouble, and I hear that one solution might be your recommendation with regard to civil rights laws. I don't know, in the changing ethnicity of our state, what civil rights laws mean anymore, other than that somehow we have to, you know, effectively educate every child Amen. In our state.
Madam
Chair. Yep.
And I want to thank you, Senator Bonhoff, for that very well said statement. Because I think that, but it is an issue that we really haven't talked about, and it's a difficult issue to talk about, and I hope that we can have continued engaged discussion on that. So with that, I'd like to thank you for coming.
Thank you
very
for
much.
Having us,
and certainly I know that for those who want more information or have questions and would like to have answered, please, I would suggest that you contact the Institute. And I want to thank both of the staff for coming today as well. So. All right, I would like to move on to Eric Mahmood, who is with Seed Academy and Harvest Prep School, who is here. And then following him will be Don Samuels and Bill Wilson. If you'd all like to come to the table, you can all be here ready to go. That's great. Thank you for coming tonight. Absolutely. We have something to pass out. And if you just want to start with Representative Abler, that's great.
Sure, thank you.
Please go ahead. Introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Eric Mahmoud. I'm the co-founder of Seed Academy Harvest Preparatory School. I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee for allowing me to talk about some of the work of our school. I just want to state that the purpose of my testimony really is to promote effective education, whether that occurs in district schools, charter schools, private schools, whether they're Hmong schools, predominantly African-American schools. What I want to promote is effective schools. There's a banner that hangs on the outside of my school or the front entrance, and as I was leaving to come to this hearing, it reminded me of the work that's necessary, that needs to be done. It's by Ron Edmonds, who was a proponent of effective school research. He says, how many effective schools would you need to see in order to be convinced of the educability of all children? He says, if the answer is more than one, I'm convinced that you have reasons of your own to believe that basic pupil performance is related to family background instead of school's response to family background. He says that we can, whenever and wherever we choose, effectively educate children who are of interest to us. The fact that we haven't done it so far will determine exactly what we do about it. And so, really, if there's one effective school, we can duplicate that. And so what I want to do is to talk about the work at Harvest Preparatory School, which I believe as one effective school. Seed Academy Harvest Preparatory School was actually founded in my home. My wife started with 10 children, and then in 1992, we evolved into a elementary school. It was a private school, and then in 1998, we decided to become a charter. And we decided to become a charter to make sure that we could serve all the children or any child that wanted to come to a school in Minneapolis. And after doing that, we began to grow significantly. We have kindergarten through sixth grade in our school. We have about 86% of our children on free and reduced lunch, about 99% African American. But what makes our school effective is what goes on in the school, not necessarily the composition of the children. And the reason why parents choose our school is because of the effectiveness of our program. In June of 2008, this past June, the Star Tribune recognized Harvest Preparatory School as one of the top 10 schools that made the greatest gain in math. That's just one indicator. You have results in front of you. If you turn to the second page, it's showing disaggregated data comparing Harvest Preparatory School performance to Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rosemont, Bloomington, Edina, and Eden Prairie. Again, disaggregated data. The first sheet is dealing with math. And you can see that Harvest Preparatory School, if you move down, has 198 students tested, and compare that to Edina, which have 163 students tested in the school district. So it's a pretty good comparison. And you can see, even though we have a higher population of students that are on free and reduced lunch, we're outperforming all those school districts in the suburbs that are educating African-American children. And the same is true for reading, the exact same picture. Our students, 60% of our students at or above grade level, and we don't believe that's anything to necessarily brag about, because we're not going to stop until we're at 100%. But what we can see is just African Americans attending a suburban school does not make the difference just by this data. In addition to the performance of our students, we have students that have graduated from Harvest Preparatory School in sixth grade, and now they graduated last year and over the last couple of years, and on average, 95% of our students are graduating from high school, and 80% of those students are going on to college. So we're seeing significant achievement from the students that have attended our school. Some of the educational strategies we believe that have been successful, number one is our longer school day. We're in school about 20% more than the average public school. So we have good teaching and more of it. We ensure that we have professional development for our teachers. They are committed, hardworking, and that also makes a difference. We also focus on results. We have a data-driven program. We are constantly looking at data. We will change directions based on the data that we are able to get from the students. We believe that those are some of the factors that makes our program successful. Let me just say in closing, before I close, this whole idea of district schools versus charter schools, we've had many collaborations with Minneapolis Public School. Minneapolis is our sponsor. We've had a program for fourth through eighth graders that actually that program was co-located in my building. They leased space from us, and we were consultants to that program. In another program about 7-8 years ago, we had kindergartners come from a nearby public school, Lincoln Elementary School, and we taught them using our reading program, and by the end of kindergarten, these kindergartners were reading at a second grade reading level. And so we've had a lot of collaboration. Again, our focus is on the academic performance of all children. In closing, contrary to what was said earlier, we're not segregationists, we're not integrationists, we're specialists. And what we specialize is the education of children in general, African-American children in particular. At one time, I had, about 3 years ago, cancer. A generalist couldn't cure my cancer. I had to go to an oncologist. He was a specialist. And so many of our parents come to us because we're specialists, because they know we do a good job with their children. Thanks again for the opportunity.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Wilson? Excuse me, Mr. Samuels, you're next. Thanks, excuse me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and
I didn't
committee.
Look at my sheet very closely here, yeah. So my apologies.
I'll go in whatever order.
Yes.
But I'm glad to be here and thankful for you and the committee for your indulgence of time. I am the City Council member for the 5th Ward in North Minneapolis, where I was chosen by the people to lead them. And I would like to think that my election was an expression of the people's wisdom in making their own decisions. Our community is hardest hit by most social dilemmas, and especially academic failure. And I get the sense that this committee has a real palpable sense of that and is a little frustrated. I certainly was, so was my wife and a group of us who started what we call the Hope Collaborative. And the word hope has great meaning and significance because we became very hopeful in delving into this problem and discovering that, in fact, there was a quiet revolution taking place in American education. All across the country, schools are discovering, as Harvest Prep has, what it takes to educate African-American, other minorities, poor children. schools have discovered this, and it's the secret is coming out. And so we formed this Hope Collaborative to bring leaders of these schools into Minneapolis to speak to the community. They also speak to the school board. They also speak to the Star Tribune editorial board. They also speak to others interested in education. And they come out and they make a presentation of what they have done in their schools. We got some of these schools from an article that the New York Times published, and it's called Still Left Behind, What It Will Really Take to Close the Education Gap. And in here they hold up several schools that have not only closed the education gap, but recreated it by making a gap of superiority among their students. And these schools are successful in educating in sending 90% plus of their students off to college. And I'm going to read you what Daisha Toll, one of the leaders of these schools, says in this article. And this article was from New York Times Sunday Magazine, November 26, 2006. And Daisha says, "We want to change the conversation from 'you can't educate these kids' to 'you can only educate these kids if.'" And to a great extent, she and the other principals have done so. And I'd like to point out that, as this article says, that the schools that Daisha Toll, Atkins, Levin, and Feinberg run are not racially integrated. Most of the 70 or so schools that make up their three networks have only one or two white children enrolled, or none at all. And although as a charter school, their admission is opened through a lottery to any students in the cities they serve, their clear purpose is to educate poor black and Hispanic children. We've been blown away by these people. I mean, you would be blown away to see the statistics that they've produced through the regimen that they have developed, and the common characteristics between these schools align. They have the regimen. It works. The students are highly motivated. They have incredible parent participation. They turn out scholars who get scholarships to superior high schools and or superior colleges. And in many cases, they return from Yale and Harvard to teach school back at the place that educated them. I'd like to pique your interest to investigate this article. I passed around two sheets of paper here titled Minnesota Voluntary Public School Choice Evaluation Report 2006-2007, prepared for the Minnesota Department of Education. And in contrast to what I've just told you, I'd like you to look at the page 38, which is the first page. The graph there shows that at every grade level, Minneapolis kids in suburbs show less progress in reading than students who remained in Minneapolis public schools. You can see that third through seventh, and then all grades. That in reading, the students showed more progress in staying in the city. And then in the next page, you see that the progress was just about equal. So what we've been talking about here, for the most part, is increments. You know, if a child goes to the suburbs, is there an incremental gain? Is there an incremental loss? I'm talking about what we've discovered as a Hope Collaborative. Incremental is out. Incremental is irrelevant. Performance levels are so low, incremental will not do. We need a revolution in education, and that is happening in select public and charter schools around the country. It is happening with incredible, predictable success year after year through methods that are similar from school to school. We found these people. They exist. It's not just a movie.
Freedom Writers.
Freedom Writers, To Sir With Love. We all make movies of them. They are not mythology. They are real. There are schools or there are groups of schools. Deschutes Toll has a group of 11 schools in the New York City public school system where she was brought in by the chancellor, and one of her schools is the fourth highest performing elementary school of the 1,100 elementary schools in the New York district. And this is a charter school with high free and reduced lunch, African American and Latino poor children. It's being done, it's a miracle, and somebody needs to shout it from the mountaintops. And so what I'm going to ask you to do is to encourage the legislature be encouraged to replicate these outstanding district and charter schools and to work with the foundations to do this. And the Hope Collaborative is producing a report that will demonstrate all of these findings and ask you to do the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Samuels. You know, there is one thing that I think everyone at this table truly believes in, and that is that we believe every child can succeed. There are no excuses. That the color of their skin, where they live, should not determine a child's education, and that it's up to us to make sure that every child achieves their full potential. So being a partner with us is extremely important. And I think what I took from that is that you're not endorsing any of these policies today, but that we have to look together to find what's best for kids.
What's working.
And what's working. Yes. And I think that's a key here is that in our traditional public schools and public charter schools, trying to differentiate that there are issues in all of our schools that need to be addressed to make them better. And whatever we can do, and this particular work group is focused on charter schools. So I welcome your testimony and want to learn more about what you're doing. And I appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
Are there
Madam
any questions?
Chair.
All right, Mr. Wilson, it is your time. So
thank you so much for
being with us.
Thanks for having me in. And you taking on this subject. It's critical. We have a choice of going forward or going backwards in education. The presentation I heard from Mr. Orfield, with all due respect to the senator, it's America the past. It's not America the future. When the Brown versus Board of Education decided in 1954, that separate but equal segregation, imposed segregation by race, is illegal, unacceptable, not American any longer. That was a major step in the right direction. I can remember, I don't know about Mr. Orfield's experience, but I can remember as a child on a yellow bus going to school, riding past three schools to get to the one school that was set aside for me. That's segregation. And to hear segregation talked about today has no relevance to segregation as it existed. It is really measuring the number of black people per square foot is being defined as segregation. And that's mythical. That's not what the courts were talking about. It said, stop segregating. To the praise of Minnesota, you passed a law saying that people have choice. That's what people wanted all the time. They wanted to let their child go to the school that was closest to them. I could have walked to school. And my friends could have walked to school, where we were bused many, many miles to a school set aside only for us. Charter schools are not set aside for any single group. It's about choice. Mr. Orfield talks about race as though it's a multiple factor, that there must be many, many races. All of the research, the scientific data shows unequivocally, infallibly, and flexibly, there's only one race. It's the human race. And to keep harping back, to make this a race issue, I think is a great mistake. It is about diversity. It's about culture. People choose. They show choice. If we get results, then what is the problem? Mr. Mahmoud testified that his school is excelling, although the composition of children of color in his school is very high. Now, I'm not surprised for that to happen. At my school, Higher Ground Academy, the vast majority of our children are new immigrant children. Many of the children coming to school have no experience previously in country with education in this country, nor do they have any experience with education, period. And in a cycle of a few years, those children are graduating successfully, and not only graduating from our school, they are accepted into college. That's one of our requirements. In order to get a diploma, they must also be accepted into college. Now, those are high standards. I would hate to see those go away. America's changed in so many ways. There are many, many more opportunities for children to get education. That's great. Parents are making wise choices. Let them choose. If it doesn't work for them, they will go to another school. Isn't that what it's all about? It's about choices. That is about as close to democracy as you can get. Let it be. When we look closely at children transferring into our schools, we do pre-post tests annually with our children because, one, we want to know, what do you know in math and language arts? And that tells us what we need to teach you. A lot of schools, I don't suspect, do that. We do that. And in doing so, we looked at the children who were being transferred into our schools because we have an open enrollment policy. We don't turn them down. We assess them, and then we put them at an appropriate grade level, and then we get busy with the education. But to my shock, if we're looking at children as late as the eighth grade coming from, and this is not a slam on the traditional public schools, coming by the eighth grade, transferring from a traditional public school, those children are three or four grade levels behind. Now, that should be the shock. That should be the wake-up call. But we see that as a challenge to educate. And if those children stick with us, they end up graduating and being accepted into college because it's about educating. Now, to me, my way of thinking, that's one of the real fallacies in Mr. Arfield's research, because students who are in charter schools, most of them didn't start there. They started somewhere else. And parents said, that's not working. Let's go and try it here. And let's go here. And let's go here. So whatever deficiencies the students had, they brought them with them. And that's this, quote, underachievement that's being alluded to here. Children are bringing those with them. It's part of the baggage. But it's our job to unload the baggage and educate those children. So charter schools are doing far better than this research would, Mr. Arfield's research would show. Now, I'm really moved by the fact that the department, Mr. Brown, Department of Education, is going to make available longitudinal data. That will give us a better fix, because we then can begin to see, you can, as legislators, begin to see where the shortcomings start happening, and it's really much earlier than much later. Our school makes AYP every year, and 99.9% of our children are children of color. They're new immigrant children. We pick no bones about it. We have an open enrollment policy, which is allows and requires. But what parents are doing is exercising choice. And what we do is hold all of our educators accountable for delivering the goods. And I say over and over at our school, we must have somewhere a school that succeeds so that somebody has a yardstick of what's success. And that's our challenge.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. I just want to pose a difficult question in that there have been schools in my community that have had incidents of where certain specific populations of children have been targets. And there have been some race issues. And those children might say, I would feel more comfortable in a all-white school. That's where I would feel better learning. And that's, I think, the dilemma that I feel is that looking at this issue is that if we are to go forward and say this is a good model for education, you know, 5 or 10 years from now, are people at this table going to say, what were they thinking when we went back to segregating students? Because we said it was a choice issue in education. And that's, I think, and I don't think you have the answer today. I think that's the discussion here is what are we doing, and is integration aid effective? Should we be spending money on that instead of doing other things? So I'm just posing, I think, what I see as some of the very difficult questions, and even saying them out loud, I think those are the things that we are struggling with, and will be. And I think it's in some of these issues are separate from the charter school discussion, but I think that the culture specific schools have raised the issue for us. And there may be some other questions. And Representative Simon,
Just a quick one.
Representative Abler after him.
Okay, any who care to answer. I agree with most of your comments, but just to be fair to Mr. Orfield, he did point out that we were likely to see today those above the line on his charts and not below. And I suspect that all three of you represent or are involved with institutions that are above the line, and that's great. We're happy to hear that. But in fairness to him and his colleagues, what do you say about those who, presumably not your schools, are below the line? Do you think there's anything that some charter schools are doing wrong that has to do with the fact that they're charter schools? Or what have you observed, without naming names, that makes it so that some of those are well below the line on his chart?
And answer, a brief answer, please.
I'll be very brief, and I think others would like to comment. Considering that most charter schools we're looking at, not much more than 5 or 6 years old, I mean, they're really very, very young in this business compared to school districts, that some of which are 90 to 100 years old. They had a longer time to succeed at educating. But the bottom line is, I think really, Senator, you have to keep in mind that the students who are coming into the charter schools are coming with some previous experience, some underperformance, and that should not be tacked on to those young, fledgling charter schools. Give them some time. Second thing I'd like to say is those are schools that can and will improve. The work that Mr. Samuels is doing with bringing in educators and challenging those educators to work with other schools and educators, show the way that can happen. I heard also that the department is going to put more emphasis on professional development. But these are windows of opportunity. So I think we have something that really works. The education really works. Now we need to work with it to make it work better, but recognize that all of the deficiencies are not of the making of the charter school.
If I can answer, I think accountability is really the bottom line. As what was stated earlier, these charter schools are probably within their second, third year. Certainly, they need to be accountable, and the accountability needs to be very tight. But they need some time in order to, number one, the staff, the students to get up to speed in order to really judge how well they're doing. And once you get to a certain point, whether you give them 3, 4, 5 years, shut them down if, in fact, they're not working out. So I think that there should be a timeline of accountability. It shouldn't be the first year. It shouldn't be the second year. There should be some period of time that charter schools need to work out some of the issues in order to demonstrate whether they're going to perform. But most, it won't happen within the first few years.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I may just make one statement. If I were to make such a projection or conclusion based on the failure of the public schools to educate African-American children, meaning let's shut them all down, I think I would not win any friends in this state. But that is the frustration I feel. And so it seems inconsistent that we would want to shut down an effort to try to change and keep what we have, which has predictably failed. Let me read something here. The message inherent in the success of the schools that I'm talking about here is that if poor students are going to catch up, they will require not the same education that middle-class children receive, but one that is considerably better. They need more time in class than middle-class students, better-trained teachers than middle-class teachers, and a curriculum that prepares them psychologically and emotionally, as well as intellectually, for the challenges ahead of them.
Representative Abler.
Just a comment and no question, but I just wanted to say I'm inspired by listening to these three gentlemen about their successes. I toured one of the schools some years ago, and I hope in all this we don't lose success stories we hear. And my only thought is, how do we bottle this and get it out where it needs to get? So thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate it.
Well, you know, on that note, I think Representative Abler, at our first meeting, one of the things that we talked about was the other intent of charter schools originally was to sort of be lab schools where successes will be brought back. And has that happened? And people talk about, well, it's competition. So, you know, that's another piece of this is what's working. So I appreciate you being here. I also hope that, you know, everyone respects that today we talked about some very difficult topics, but that we tried to provide equal time for everyone to present and talk about that. And obviously there's additional conversations, but those will have to take part at another time. Representative Slocum, do you want to talk about our next meeting?
Our next meeting is December 17th at 4:30 in room 200, I believe. 200? At the state office building. We're going to be looking at, and we welcome proposals for legislative proposals for consideration. If you have an idea, a way to fix, to make better, to replicate successful charter schools or to make them more responsive, more accountable, we are interested in what you have to say. And We'll put together an agenda, so if you would give us a call and let us know if you're interested in presenting something.
And Senator Wieger.
Yes, Madam Chair, very briefly, excellent hearing. We mentioned the public service for the record that Senator Orfield had and Council Member Samuelson. I remember Bill Wilson when I was just starting out 30 years ago as a school board member at age 21, 35 years ago, but Bill Wilson was a trailblazer, city council member in St. Paul, and first president, African-American, of the St. Paul City Council, and wanted everyone, if you didn't know, that he's, like others, has a significant background and testimony.
Excellent. Well, with that, I'd like to adjourn the meeting, and thank you to everyone for staying late tonight.